Carl Sagan, now there's a good two words to start out our study of Genesis. Carl Sagan wrote and narrated the television series entitled Cosmos, A Personal Voyage, which was produced in 1980. As of 2009, just a few years ago, it was still the most widely watched PBS series of all time. That's how popular it has been. And he famously says in the opening segment of Cosmos these words: "The cosmos is all that is, or was, or ever will be. Our feeblest contemplations of the cosmos stir us. There is a tingling in the spine, a catch in the voice, a faint sensation as if a distant memory of falling from a height. We know we are approaching the greatest of mysteries." And if you remember that series, you can almost visualize him standing on the shores of the ocean and the rocks and intoning these majestic words. The popular television series is one of the most effective explanations of a religion, of a faith system, because that's what it is. It is a faith system called materialism. Materialism is a faith system that is built on the eternality of the material world. Carl Sagan and many others worship the cosmos, and you can grasp that in those opening words. Well, the opening words of the Bible categorically deny materialism. We could not have two more opposite viewpoints on life than Carl Sagan's statement that the cosmos is all that is or was or ever will be, and the opening words of the Bible: "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Those are as opposite as you can get. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, the cosmos. The end of Genesis 1, the first chapter, says these words: "And God saw all that he had made, and it was good." God was happy. God made the cosmos, and God said it was good. And he was pleased with his creation. So creation exists for the pleasure of the Creator. Genesis 1 tells us that the eternally self-existent God created the cosmos for himself. He did it because he wanted to do it. He took pleasure in his creation. And God looked at it and he said it was good. The cosmos is incredibly intricate and complex, showing us a God who is incredibly creative and inventive. God takes pleasure in his creation just as any creator takes pleasure in what he creates. This morning we're going to introduce the book of Genesis from verse 1. The book of Genesis is the book of beginnings. Genesis, the English title for the book, really comes from the Latin Vulgate and from the Greek Septuagint translation. And the word means beginning. The Hebrew title for this book is Bereshit, which is simply the first word of the first verse of the entire Bible, Bereshith, in the beginning. The opening sentence of the Bible is perhaps the simplest and most profound sentence in all of Scripture. If you don't believe Genesis 1:1, then the gospel is irrelevant. It is perhaps the simplest and most profound sentence in all of Scripture. And there are only five words in the Hebrew text. But the last two, heavens and earth, are tied together grammatically in the Hebrew. So we could say that there are basically four words in this amazing statement. Let's unpack those four words, all right? First of all, everything has a beginning except God. The first word in the Hebrew text is in the beginning. It's one word. Now, I have to deal with a translation issue before we can examine what this word tells us. Some translations, and you might have one, read, "When God began to create." When God began to create. Instead of, "In the beginning God created." Bear with me for a moment. I've got to be technical here. They are taking the first word of this verse in the Hebrew text as a construct form instead of an absolute form. And that is grammatically possible. The word could be taken in a construct form rather than an absolute form in the Hebrew. But not here, for the following reasons. Number one, it requires us to amend the verb create and make it a construct as well, meaning to create instead of create, to create instead of create. And that's not what the word is in the Hebrew text. Number two, the ancient Masoretes, the oldest translators we have for the Hebrew, the scribes who wrote and transcribed the Old Testament, place a little marker on this verse indicating that this is an absolute form and not a construct form. Three, all the oldest versions of the Bible, including the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, translated as an absolute statement. And four, John 1:1, New Testament, follows the Septuagint in translating it how? In the beginning. So, this is an absolute statement, and translating it as when God began to create is an incorrect translation. Why is that important? It is important because if it is translated when God began to create, then matter already existed. The statement is, in the beginning, God created. And that tells us that there was no matter that preceded this creation. This is the beginning. And that's very important. The word beginning means beginning. Sounds rather dull. Sorry. It means the first, the start, the initial act. Science may trace the cosmos back to a Big Bang, but it cannot go before the Big Bang. The Bible does. In the beginning, God. God was before the beginning. At the very first of everything that ever was, God was. That's an amazing sentence. Before the origin of life, God was there. Now here's the thing. Science cannot speak to the origin of life because science cannot replicate a time before life began. In his book, God's Undertaker, Has Science Buried God, John Lennox quotes a number of scientists. I'm not talking about Christian scientists here. I'm talking about non-Christian scientists who admit their ignorance about the origin of life. They're all involved in various projects to try and replicate the origin of life. And they all, he quotes many, we'll just look at a couple of his quotes. They all say this. Francis Crick, "The origin of life seems almost to be a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have had to have been satisfied to get it going." Now, Francis Crick is a scientist who is involved in origin of life studies, and he is not a supernaturalist. He does not believe in the supernatural. He does not believe in miracles, but he says, seems almost to be a miracle. Stuart Kaufman from the Santa Fe Science Institute claims, "Anyone who tells you that he or she knows how life started on the earth some 3.45 billion years ago is a fool or a knave. Nobody knows." That's coming from a scientist. All right, the book of Genesis is the book of origins. And as we study Genesis, we will study the origin of virtually every single important facet of human life. The beginning of everything that is important to humanity. You know, a world life view that has any meaning must address the origin of many things that are important to human life. And the book of Genesis does exactly that. So a Judeo-Christian answer to all of the important questions of life begins with Genesis, which is why it is so vital that people understand Genesis if we're going to do anything, evangelize anybody in this world. So we will learn, for example, here's just a summary little list. We will learn about the origin of the cosmos and the origin of life. We will study the origin of humans and the origin of sin or evil. Every world life view has to have an answer for evil as it relates particularly to humans, the origin of sin or evil or bad in this world. Genesis answers that. We will learn about the origin of marriage and family. God created humans. God designed marriage and family to meet the needs of humans. His design for marriage and family is perfect, even if our world rejects that design today. We will study the origin of judgment and the beginning of grace. We will study the origin of languages. Where did they come from? Races and racial issues. And nations. Genesis addresses all of those issues. We will learn of the origin of Israel and the origin of Arabs and the conflict that exists between those two peoples. We will study the origin of covenant and the agreements that God and humans make with each other. No wonder it's called the Book of Beginnings, right? And there are many other examples we could give of beginnings. So, in the beginning, everything has a beginning except God. Secondly, God is the ruler of everything. God is the ruler of everything. In the beginning, God. The second word is God. These statements... You know, it sounds so basic and pedantic to say it like this, but it is vital to our world life view, our Christian faith, that we start with Genesis today, because if we do not start here with these very basic issues, we can go nowhere in terms of talking to people about Jesus Christ and the gospel. If this is rejected in the first place. This one word in the opening sentence of the Bible says so much. God is self-existent in the beginning, you see. God is self-sufficient. He needs no one or nothing. God is before all things. God is above all things. He is before all matter even existed. He is above all matter that now exists. He is before the cosmos. He is above the cosmos. He does not need us. He does not need you. He does not need this universe. God is self-existent. God is self-sufficient. And all that he created to enjoy. But he was perfectly happy before he created anything. The word God that is used here is a plural form of his name. Interesting. But the verb to create is singular. So, immediately in the first verse of the Bible, we are introduced to the plurality of God in the singularity of God. Now that's a mystery you can spend the next 10 years studying and never understand. God is plural, meaning that he enjoys relationships with others in himself. He needs no one else to have relational joy. He is self-sufficient in his relationships. God is singular, meaning that there is only one God. There is no other. God is personal. He is a personal being, not an impersonal force. So this personal, self-existent, self-sufficient being creates all that exists. And we've only covered the first two words of the Bible. We learn from this one verse many statements about God's character and nature that deny five major errors that humans have developed down through history. Obviously, first of all, it denies atheism. That's pretty obvious. This verse leaves no room for atheism. Second, it denies polytheism. The ancient world was filled with polytheism, the concept of many gods. By the way, the Babylonian record of creation, the Enuma Elish, is filled with a very incredible story of how this universe came into existence with gods and goddesses and fighting and blood and all of this sort of thing, if you ever read it. They were filled with polytheists, lots of gods and goddesses. We start out, there is one God and one God only. Denies polytheism. Third, it denies naturalism. Naturalism argues that all of life can be explained by natural causes. Everything you do and think can be explained by natural causes. There is nothing supernatural. Everything is defined by natural causes. Obviously, this verse denies naturalism, for the beginning is supernatural. It denies pantheism. Pantheism is that God exists in everything, the trees and the flowers and all of that. Obviously, God exists here outside the universe that he creates. He made the trees, he made the sun, he made the stars. He does not exist within creation. And it refutes materialism. Matter is not eternal. Matter had a beginning, and God brought matter into existence. God created matter. All right, if this is true, if this verse is true, and it is, then man is not the king of his universe. Who's the king? God. Man is not the master of his destiny. Who's the master? God. God is creator. God is ruler. Not man. Many scientists refuse to accept the concept of intelligent design. You know that. There's a lot of debate on campuses regarding intelligent design. But they refuse to accept the concept of intelligent design, not because there is no scientific evidence for creation, but because to accept intelligent design is to accept a God who is the creator. And if you accept God as creator, then you have to ultimately accept God as ruler, as master. And that humans do not want to do. Man does not want to accept a creator God who rules. We are in rebellion against a creator God who rules. So humans rebel against surrendering to God as creator and ruler. They will do anything and believe anything to avoid the concept of a creator God who rules his creation. And modern man has done a wonderful job, if you will, of cutting himself off from such a beginning. Modern man is free. We've been liberated from all of those ideas about a creator, ruler, God. But at what cost have we liberated ourselves? Once you deny God as creator, then you deny God as ruler. And once you deny God as ruler, then anything goes. Morality is determined by man. Right and wrong are our prerogatives if there is no creator God. So man is free to do his own thing, but the result is moral anarchy. And the only thing that holds it together is whoever has the power to make laws and control behavior and enforce things. And we see the results of that moral anarchy in our world today, right? We continue to see that devolution. And it all starts by denying the Creator God. That's why it is so vital that we believe in Genesis 1. Now, we can see this play out in the book of Genesis, because in a very real way, as I introduce this book, Genesis is really the story of human rebellion, isn't it? Over and over again, we will see humans rebelling against God. Actually, all sin is ultimately rebellion. Every sin we ever commit is ultimately rebellion against God. That's the definition of sin, theologically. And Genesis will tell us the story of rebellion. So, modern rebellion is simply the continuation of the story of rebellion beginning in Genesis. Adam and Eve chose to eat from the forbidden fruit, the tree. God said, "You got everything, enjoy it, except one tree." And they had to eat from that one tree, right? That's rebellion. That's rebellion against God. The Tower of Babel in Genesis chapter 11, we'll look at that. The Tower of Babel is all about humans who said, "Let's build a tower that will reach to heaven so we will be greater than God." That's rebellion. We can stand against God. What's one of the most interesting things, and as we look at things like the Tower of Babel, is what's the one thing that unites humans and nations and peoples against God? Can't get together on any other thing, but we can get together against God. We can unite against God. Rebellion. The book of Genesis is all about rebellion. Now, what we learn in the book of Genesis is that once humans rebel against God, what happens? They begin to rebel against each other. It's inevitable. There is open rebellion toward one another. So the essence of sin is rebellion, but all rebellion against God eventually leads to rebellion against other humans. So Adam and Eve rebel against God, and Cain kills Abel. in the next story. Rebellion against God inevitably leads to rebellion against other humans. I will not listen to you, and I will not listen to you. It's going to happen. And the story continues. Cain, incredible civilizations that his descendants built, but Lamech kills a man in an argument and celebrates it. And the world, the early chapters of Genesis are the story of one rebellion after another as humans fought with each other. And the world becomes so corrupt and so filled with violence and evil as humans fought humans that what happens? God sends the flood to clean up this rotten world. And the flood gives a reprieve. But it doesn't last. Why? Because the human heart is still rebelling against God and therefore against one another. And the world continues to devolve into wars and conflicts and sex and lies. That's Genesis right there. That's the story of Genesis, the story of beginnings. Where does evil come from? Where does sin come from in our human world? We've met the enemy, and he is us. It's us. We like to fight. We like to rebel against God and against one another. And yet, the story of Genesis is not just about rebellion, of course. God rules over it all, even as humans rebel. That's very important because we live in a world of rebellion against God, and yet God is still ruling. Amen? There are those who do not rebel. Noah and Abraham. Men like Joseph. At the end of the book, we end up with the story of Joseph. Joseph, of course, is sold into slavery. You know these stories well. He's sold into slavery by his own brothers. But the book of Genesis ends with a clarion call to trust in God's rulership that overrides all human evils. Listen to Joseph in Genesis chapter 50, the end of this book of beginnings. "As for you," Joseph says, he's in Egypt now, "you meant evil against me, even in our family, you know. You sold me into slavery. You meant evil against me." And families sometimes can be the worst places for evil to exist, right? "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Then he goes on to say, "When God takes you up, what are you to do? Take my bones with you to our homeland. Take my bones with you to our homeland." Why? God's going to take care of you. God's still ruling. God's still in charge. The world may be filled with rebellion, violence. I may be dying far away from my homeland in the country of Egypt, but trust God. God rules. That's how the book of Beginnings ends. Right? So God is in charge of his creation. God is the ruler of everything. No matter what happens in our lives, no matter what we face in this world, no matter how much evil seems to thrive in this world, we can trust God. No matter how many bad things happen, we can trust him. No matter what you face today, you can trust him. He's still on his throne. That's Genesis. Third principle. Everything begins with creation. In the beginning, first word, God, second word, created, third word. Created is the third word of the sentence. The Hebrew word that is used here is in a form that is called the cal stem. In the cal stem, this word is only used of God in the entire Old Testament. The subject of this verb in the cal stem is never humans. It is always God. So we have an all-powerful, sovereign God creating this universe, and the word means to initiate something new. It meant to bring something new into existence. And since it is only used of God, then it is something that is outside the scope of man's ability to do. So this word is the best Hebrew word to communicate a concept we call creation ex nihilo. That is, creation out of nothing. God created something out of nothing. There was nothing in the beginning, and God created something out of nothing. Now, humans don't want to admit that God created something out of nothing. John Gerstner, commenting on this verse, tells the story of his high school physics teacher. The teacher said in class, "The greatest question which has ever been asked is why there is something rather than nothing." The greatest question that has ever been asked is why there is something rather than nothing. That's what the physics teacher said. And John Gerstner says in his younger days he was very impressed with that question until he realized it's not a question at all. In fact, it's not even a legitimate question. It's not profound at all. Because if nothing is really nothing, then there's no comparison. You can't compare nothing with something. There's no choice at all. What is nothing? Anybody tell me? What is nothing? Well, as soon as you say nothing is, you have something. It's illogical. In fact, the Puritan pastor and author Jonathan Edwards once said, "Nothing is what the sleeping rocks dream of." Which led Gerstner to observe, "Anyone who thinks he knows what nothing is must have those rocks in his head." All right, here's the problem. Science simply cannot speak to the issue of origin because science can never replicate nothing. Science cannot even define nothing. Now, you're all reading. I should have waited to put that quote up. You're all reading it, not listening to me, right? The science postulates that life began with the Big Bang. But what did the Big Bang start with? Even the Big Bang started with something, not nothing. And that is why materialism was born. Carl Sagan popularized materialism by saying, "The cosmos is all that is or was or ever will be," right? He writes in that series, "The Hindu religion is the only one of the world's great faiths dedicated to the idea that the cosmos itself undergoes immense, indeed an infinite number of deaths and rebirths. It is the only religion in which the time scales correspond to those of modern scientific cosmology. Its cycles run from our ordinary day and night to a day and night of Brahma, 8.64 billion years long, longer than the age of the earth or the sun, and about half the time since the Big Bang." So the answer of atheistic science is a non-answer, is what it is. It's a non-answer. It hides behind billions of years. By hiding behind the Big Bang, billions of years in the past, science simply fails to address the origin of something out of nothing. 16 billion years will still never create something out of nothing. But it's a smokescreen. It's hiding behind that concept. Atheists are often like the man who is climbing a steep mountain cliff. He gets almost up to the summit of this mountaintop, and he begins to slide. And as he's sliding, he's about to go to this steep rock cliff face that's going to drop 1,000 feet to the valley below. And he's sliding down here, and he goes over the edge of the cliff, and he chanced to grab a hold of a branch. Right? And he's hanging there by the branch. Now, this man is not a religious man. But all of a sudden, he looks toward heaven because he knows that he can't hang on forever. And he says to the heavens, "Is there anyone up there who can help me?" He didn't really expect an answer, after all. So he was surprised when a voice responded to him and said, "Yes, I am here, and I can help you. But first, you must let go of the branch." There's a long pause, and the man looked up again and called out, "Is there anybody else up there? Second opinion, please." That, my friends, is what the atheist or the atheistic scientist is doing by postulating billions of years, desperately seeking another answer to the question of something out of nothing. Anything but God will do. Give me another answer. Please give me anything but God. Fourth principle. History is his story about everything. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, the cosmos. So the story of the cosmos is the story of God. History is his story. This universe is not about you, and it is not about me. You are not the center of this story, and neither am I. History is his story. It is all about God. So Genesis is introducing the story of God and his dealings with man. And creation is the first chapter of God's story. That's why it is so important for us to take Genesis 1 as serious history. It is not myth. It is not analogy. It is not allegory. Genesis 1 is nothing less than history because it is the first chapter of God's history, you see. And we see this throughout the Bible. The Bible consistently treats Genesis 1 as serious history. The creation account is viewed as an historical record. Let me give you but one example, because we could do many this morning. We don't have time. Give you but one example. Francis Schaeffer, by the way, in his book Genesis in Space and Time, makes this point very clear. And he uses Psalm 136 to do it. Psalm 136 shows us that the creation story is just as much history as the history of the Jewish people. There's no difference between the story of creation and the story of Israel. Look at verses 5 through 9. We'll put it up here. "To him who made the heavens with skill, for his loving kindness is everlasting. To him who spread out the earth above the waters, for his loving kindness is everlasting. To him who made the lights, for his loving kindness is everlasting. The sun to rule by day, for his loving kindness is everlasting. The moon and the stars to rule by night, for his loving kindness is everlasting." Wonderful. That's the creation story, right? The next verse continues that same theme, but now we're talking about Israel. to him who smote the Egyptians in their firstborn, for his loving kindness is everlasting, and brought Israel out from their midst, for his loving kindness is everlasting, to him who divided the Red Sea asunder, for his loving kindness is everlasting, and made Israel pass through the midst of it, for his loving kindness is everlasting. But he overthrew Pharaoh and his army in the Red Sea, for his loving kindness is everlasting. On and on it goes, by the way. We go to Og, we go to the wilderness, we go to the battles. They just go on and on. Same thing. God did this, for his loving kindness is everlasting. So what are we doing with all of that? Why is that important? Do you see that we cannot separate the history of the Bible from the creation account? The Bible will not let us do that. The one thing we cannot say is that Genesis 1 is myth or analogy, but the story of Israel, Egypt, and the Pharaoh is history. See, we can't do that. We can't say that God brought Israel out of Egypt and through the Red Sea, and that is a historical record, but creation is a non-historical record, because the Bible consistently says they are the same historical record. Ties them together. This is just but one example, by the way. So the Bible treats both of them as equally history because they are equally his story, you see. So next Sunday, we will be talking about the creation account. We'll have to deal with the age of life on earth and how did this process take place. But what we cannot do is say that this account is a myth. It is a historical record, just as much as the rest of the Bible is historical record. All right. Just a quick word, then, about the story of Genesis, because we are introducing the book. It can be divided into 10 segments based on a phrase called the Toledoth. It is often translated, these are the generations of. But it can roughly be translated, this is the story of. And it is repeated 10 times in the book of Genesis. So this is the breakdown of the book of Genesis. And each repeat introduces a new story, which is all part of the same story because it's God's story. All right? 10 times the phrase is repeated, and as you can see in this chart, dividing Genesis into 10 historical segments, God is the author of the history, and creation is the first story. Genesis 1, then, is the introduction to the story that God is writing in this book of beginnings. All right, we have to wrap this up. As I said, next Sunday we'll talk about the verses here and the creation account and how we deal with some of the issues related to that. But what's the takeaway from all of this morning? Well, one takeaway is that we cannot expect people to believe the gospel if they don't believe the creation. We live in a post-Judeo-Christian world today where people do not believe the biblical record regarding these matters. Don't believe that God is the creator at all. The good news of Jesus Christ means nothing until you start with God the creator and our rebellion against him. So, one of the problems we face in talking with people today is that we have to go back to the beginning. We have to do what I call pre-evangelism oftentimes, because they aren't even starting from the same starting point that we are. So we go and we want to talk about sin and salvation and redemption and grace and the good news of salvation. They're not even there. They don't even believe God exists. They don't even believe that God created and that he rules or that man sinned. We have to go back to the beginning in order to work people through to the point where they're ready to hear about the gospel in the first place. We have to back up and start with God and creation and sin and rebellion before the gospel makes any sense. We have to start with Genesis to get to the gospels, in other words. By the way, this is the technique that some mission agencies use with primitive peoples in places like Papua New Guinea. They don't start with the New Testament. Where do they start? Genesis. And they walk the tribal peoples through the story, the entire story of the Bible, so that when they get to Jesus, they are ready to listen to Jesus. And it's effective. Well, we are living in that post-Judeo-Christian culture, and we more and more have to do that because people just aren't even there in their presuppositions and their assumptions. We talk about God and sin and salvation and Jesus, and they look at us like we're from another planet sometimes. All right, second takeaway is that we exist to serve God. God does not exist to serve us. Pastor Tim Keller in Manhattan, New York, said that in 1970, a Sunday school teacher changed his life with a very simple illustration. It's an illustration I personally remember well from my high school years at that same time, which I suppose dates me. But I remember it well because I wrote it down. And I have it in my files from back in the early 70s when it was a pretty common illustration. And the teacher said this: let's assume that the distance between the earth and the sun, from here to the sun, is 92 million miles. And that distance can be reduced to the thickness of this one sheet of paper. So this one sheet of paper represents the distance from the earth to the sun. Right? If that is the case, then the distance between the earth and the nearest star would be a stack of this paper 70 feet high. And that's the nearest star, with each sheet representing the distance from the earth to the sun, 70 feet. And the diameter of the galaxy in which we live, just our own galaxy, would be a stack of papers 310 miles high, where each sheet represents the distance from the earth to the sun. And then the teacher said in that Sunday school class, the galaxy is just a speck of dust in the universe. And yet, God holds the universe together. Jesus does, by the word of his power, Colossians 1, right? God created it all. Then the teacher asked this question: now, is this the kind of person you ask into your life to be your assistant? Is this the kind of person you ask into your life to be your assistant? But isn't that how we most often treat God? He's our assistant. He's here to solve what we need done. No, you can't study creation and God as the creator and come away asking him into your life to be your assistant. Last weekend, we walked up to some ledges behind Papoose Pond. It's higher than Pulpit Rock, which you look down toward, and you look out from those ledges, and you see all the way to the White Mountains. It's a nice vista, beautiful. I'd been reading and thinking and studying, how do you pull stuff together on Genesis 1 and God's creation? And as I sat there and reflected, all I could think about was, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You know, it's kind of a wow God at that moment, isn't it? Maybe you experience it when you stand and look at the stars on a moonless night. Wow God. Or a beautiful sunset. Wow God. right? Wow, God. Wow, God is the first tottering baby step of faith. It's the beginning of faith. You know, you don't have to have all your questions answered. In fact, you never will in this life have all your questions answered, all the whys, all the issues that you'd like God to tell you. We all spend much time going, God, I don't get it. I don't understand. Why? Why this? You don't have to have all your questions answered to believe God. You just have to start and come back to on a regular basis that first tottering baby step of faith. Wow, God. Wow. Father, teach us your wow, for you are great and awesome. In Jesus' name, amen.